Welcome to Your Call. Rose Aguilar is out today. I'm Angie Cuero. In the classic Peanuts comic strip, little girl Lucy set up her own advice booth. For a mere 5 cents, she would set your world straight in her unmistakably frank style. Imagine, though, one of her clients coming up and asking about climate change. Even Lucy might have been stymied by that one. Kate Shapira is not. She's got a booth, too. It says Climate Anxiety Counseling, an actual booth that this writer and poet sets up in public to talk global warming with people walking by, how to deal with the stress, how to move from paralysis into action, from isolation to community. She's written a book stuffed with lessons and advice. It is Lessons from the Climate Anxiety Counseling Booth, How to Live with Care and Purpose in an Endangered World. Its chapters have subheadings like From Isolation to Connection, From Grief to Possibility, and From Despair to Reimagination. We will spring the 5 cents for you today so you can benefit from just this advice. Kate Shapira teaches nonfiction writing at Brown University. She's published 6 books of poetry. You might have seen her byline in Catapult, The Rumpus, and The Toast. She co-edited The Educator's Guide to Climate Emotions. We'll talk about that later this hour. And she's currently on the line from Providence. Kate, welcome.
Angie, thank you so much for having me.
I'm glad to. Now, I want to clarify, the book comes not from the work in psychology or psychiatry. This is a matter of sharing wisdom and community from an experienced author activist. Is that a fair way to put it?
I think that is fair. And I would also add that through the conversations at the Climate Anxiety Counseling Booth, I became an experienced listener.
Mm.
That's how I would describe this work now, I think, as climate listening.
That's interesting to me because one of the things I had noted was we hear a lot, of course, about climate change, and it's almost relentlessly grim, understandably, because there are headlines coming out all the time, and it's, you know, this ice shelf has collapsed. This species is on the verge of extinction. It makes sense because new things are being discovered every day, and they are relentlessly grim. But to have someone listen to you about what's happening inside your own head and heart about climate change, and maybe even exchange some good and encouraging steps, that's really rare. Where did you get the idea to do this?
You mentioned it partly in your introduction, that I had read these collections of Peanuts and seen Lucy out there with her little booth. But before that, I was motivated just by my own climate grief, ecological grief, that I read in an article about coral bleaching that talked about climate change in the past tense. That was back in, I want to say, 2013. And when I would try to talk with people about this, it seemed like they found it very difficult to talk about. And I was frustrated. I felt isolated. I felt alone in this sort of sea of grief and anger and frustration. And I thought, what would enable people to talk about this with me? What would enable me to talk about it with others?
And it's interesting to me that you saw there was the potential for resilience there in just talking to others. It's not like you solved the problem for yourself and said, I'm going to take this out to the people. You were in a position of vulnerability when you set up to talk to people.
That's right. And I remain there. I remain vulnerable, as we all are, both in the sense that climate change affects us all, though, of course, it affects some of us sooner and harder than others. And that's directly related, I think, to where we are in hierarchies of power, mm-hmm. but also in the sense that when you are vulnerable, you are open, and you're open, exposed to being hurt, but you're also open to being cared for and to being heard.
Mm-hmm. You know, there is humor in this. There's a humor in a woman deciding to set up a booth that frankly looks like Lucy's. It's even got the 5 cent sign and the doctor is in. You might think that if some random woman shows up and puts up a duplicate of Lucy's booth advertising climate anxiety counseling, at best, people might look at you askance and walk kind of a larger circle around you. But that's not what happened. Why do you think people were inclined to take the shot of talking to you?
I think partly because it is funny a little. The booth is also, it's very clearly made out of garbage. It's made out of cardboard and a plywood table that I found on the street. It's small, it's unassuming. I think it makes just the look of it makes it feel like a conversation might be possible.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing how hard it is to have these conversations, anything that makes them feel possible, if people are looking for that, they go towards it instead of away from it. And I think the need was there. I mean, I got people my first day. I've never had a day where no one stopped. And people share what they're thinking, what they have witnessed, what they're feeling, what they fear, and also sometimes what they hope for.
Mm-hmm. I was looking at an article about your work in Nautilus, and this really stuck with me. One of the first people who came to speak with her that day was addled by his imagination. He told her he was carrying an image in his mind of a world melted and burnt, devoid of clean water, but he'd kept this to himself. And the article quotes you as saying he had this very catastrophic, apocalyptic nightmare vision, and he'd never told anyone about it. I can just imagine, as you were saying, this ability to have some sort of release when you know, walking by, this person is open to hearing this horrific thing I've been keeping to myself.
The other thing that I learned from doing the booth was just how many people are hungry to be heard in their nightmares, in their more ordinary fears, in the things that they feel that they can't talk about. And part of the reason why I think the booth works for people is that talking about what you have seen, felt, heard, known, feared, is the first step to a longer process that can lead to genuine connection and collective action. But it's impossible to take that step without first being heard and mm-hmm. hearing another person.
Mm-hmm. Is there a consistency? Well, in fact, let's back up. You started this in 2014. And I'm wondering, back then, when the coverage was perhaps not as intense as it is now, it was out there. People knew about climate change. There was already dispute about whether it was real, man-made. A lot of dispute. We can talk about that, too. But I'm wondering how the message you're getting from people coming by, how that has differed over the years. What were you first hearing in 2014 by contrast to what you're hearing in 2024?
The biggest change that I have heard is that when people started coming up to me, very often they were talking about climate change in terms of their children, their children's children, the fears for the lives that those people were going to have, but they were not really talking about it very much in terms of their own life, their own work, their own well-being. They were talking about it very much as something that was going to happen in the future. I don't hear that anymore. People know that it's happening now. They feel that it's happening now. They witness it. Even if they're not witnessing its most severe impacts, they see it in the light, they feel it on their skin, as well as seeing it on the news.
So let's walk through a session here. Someone comes to you with this sense of immediacy now. They may have children, they may have grandchildren. Of course, they're concerned for that world as well, but they're concerned about the present world. And they feel, and I'm sure this is universal, they feel helpless. Above all, they feel helpless and they feel alone, according to your book. Where do you start? I walk up to you. I have this concern. I tell you I'm helpless and I feel alone. Where do we start together?
I think if you came up saying that to me, I would say, do you talk to people about this? And then you might say yes or no. What would you say, actually?
I would, if I were in that position, I would say no. It's terrifying.
And then I might say, well, if you were going to talk to someone, who would you want to talk to?
I would like to talk to someone who already knows what's going on because I don't want to depress anybody.
Ooh, okay. Well, who do you know who already knows what's going on?
Probably somebody at the university.
Someone that you know? Someone that you work with?
Yeah, a science teacher.
Okay, wonderful. What's getting in the way for you of speaking with that person?
Well, I figure they're probably pretty, you know, depressed themselves. I just don't like bringing this up to people. Where do you go with it? What are you going to do? You find out what's going on, and so what? You just know what's going on. You can't fix it.
Well, that's what you know right now or how it feels. But one of the things that this person might know is what they're doing about it, or maybe you could look something up together. It kind of depends on how that conversation goes. Is there something that you're afraid they might do if you bring it up?
No, I'm just afraid I'm afraid it would be even more discouraging. I don't need to hear more bad stuff.
Ah, I gotcha. Okay, that makes total sense to me. I can understand why you might not want to be like, oh, now both of us are scared, upset, frightened, angry. Whatever it actually is that you're feeling. But what if you're wrong? Not wrong about what's happening.
Right.
If you're wrong about how it might feel to hear someone else say, hey, yeah, me too.
If I thought somebody that informed and that educated was worried also, I'd feel that much less alone, but I'd still feel like it doesn't get us anywhere practically.
Absolutely. So I think then, let's say that the two of you are able to have this conversation. Can you tell me more about what you're looking for, what you're longing for?
I want to know if there really is anything we could actually do, because it's very, very big, and it's nature, and it's done, and it doesn't feel like we can fix anything.
Yeah, the hugeness of it is almost overwhelming. That's something that I hear a lot. It's something that I feel a lot myself, actually, that like, oh my God, like the problem is so large and I am so small. I think I would also submit to you that, you know, two people are also not as big as the problem, but they're bigger than one person if you put them together. And I wonder who else you might be able to talk with. And I also wonder who else this person might know. Do you happen to know if there's anyone either at the university or in your town who is already working on this?
You know who I'm going to pay attention to now, Kate, is those who are just tuning in and saying, what kind of therapy session have I tuned into? So, Kate's book is all about what she has learned with her own climate anxiety counseling booth. And we're just doing a little role playing there as to how she talks to the people that approach her and are looking for a little peace, a little way to act in a more positive way, and frankly, to deal with their fear. I'm wondering, Kate, if you encounter a lot of anger, because there was a mention of that in there.
Yeah, definitely. And it takes all forms, right? Sometimes people are angry at people who are doing what they perceive to be less than them to respond to the climate crisis. Often they're angry at elected officials, people in charge of corporations, people who they feel have more power than they do.
Mm.
Sometimes they're angry at themselves. It sort of shows up as a combination of guilt and anger. Like, I know I should do X, or why can't I do Y? Why is it so hard to do Z? But in a way that shows some anger. So yes, absolutely, anger is a part of this. And I often, from folks who are younger especially, I would say, I hear some anger that they have to deal with this at all.
Yeah.
Feeling that they've been put in this position by people who were at least theoretically more informed, who have chosen to push us further down this path.
That gets into some really hairy areas. I'm imagining you talking to someone, you know, 18, 20 years old. It almost would feel, I'm wondering if you feel there's any value in validating that maybe earlier generations should have done something. How do you, as the person who's kind of steering this conversation, how do you grasp the right angle to approach someone, for example, in that position? Where do you start?
Well, I guess, first of all, I don't always, you know, sometimes I get it wrong to start. And I think that even that has value, because then the person has to correct me, right? If they have a little patience with me, then they redirect me. They say, no, this is what I'm actually talking about. Or they say, well, not exactly. It's more like this. And even defining that a little bit more for themselves. So saying like, well, I wouldn't say I'm angry. I'm more like frustrated. Okay, great. Now you know what it is that you are, and you have the opportunity to connect on a true basis, a true footing. So even the mistakes, I think, usually get us somewhere. And then I just try to, like I did with you a moment ago, I just try to listen, like, what feels like the heart of what this person is saying?
Mm-hmm.
And ask more questions to lead us closer to that.
Right. You know, it's interesting to me, we're already getting phone calls off the air, so I want to go ahead and open our phones a little bit early. Our show is, in fact, a little shorter today because we're in a membership drive, so if you would like to contribute to this conversation, if you have questions for Kate, if you would like to give your own comments about what you've been able to do, how you've struggled yourself out of the anxiety or the anger or the climate depression, we'd love to hear from you. Get on the phone at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We're also watching the inbox, so you can send us a line at yourcall@kalw.org. Yourcall@kalw.org. That off-the-air caller says, I feel guilty because I have to drive a car to work every day because I live far away from my job. That sounds like something one couldn't really fix. I know that Providence, I think, is quite different, but here in the Bay Area, it's really hit and miss whether public transit is a good option for you. So that might feel to that person as though they're trapped in something they know is, quote unquote, wrong for the environment. They have to drive to work every day. How do you deal with that?
Absolutely. And I want to also just say that is so, so common. I get that all the time, even in tiny Providence, certainly for people who come from further afield when I do the booth elsewhere. This is a car-constructed country at the moment. It's very difficult to avoid driving perhaps more than you would wish. And so to that person, I hear you. I get it. It's very, very common. I can really truthfully say you are not alone. I think, however, Angie, in the point that you raised, this is a situation where this person maybe can't do anything. They got to get to work.
Right,
and
right.
Got to drive their car to do it. However, you also said that public transit is hit or miss.
Yes.
I've been to the Bay Area, and I know that for my own self. Does this person have the interest, the capacity, the capability, the skill that they could lend to an effort to make public transit in the Bay more hit and less miss?
So becoming an activist along that line.
Yes. And I also want to stress, and this is something I talk about quite a bit in the book too, becoming an activist, if you've never done it, I think that the ideas that people have of what it's like, if they've never done it, are a little narrower than what it can actually be. For this person, it might start just with doing a search for who all is organizing already around transit in the Bay. It might involve clearing, not even an hour, 20 minutes a day to look that up and see if there's anything missing or anything that they could add their skills, their time, their energy, or their insight to.
Mm-hmm. So there's the value of community there as well, then, if they're linking up with people and not being alone with this, here I am in my car being a bad person.
Absolutely. And I think that there is also something, I don't know if healing is the right word, but strengthening in doing a little investigation and learning that there are actually people trying to work on the component of this that troubles you the most.
Where does one look for leadership? I mean, I understand the value of one-to-one. You find people that are having the same concerns as you, who might be on a parallel with you in terms of power, ability, knowledge. How does one go about searching for leadership?
That is such a good question. I have a kind of sequence in the book of questions that you might ask if you're looking for who you might want to be organized by in a climate or environmental justice effort. I think you want to be looking for people who have been doing it for a while, mm-hmm. who are rooted in the community where you are also living or working or even playing. I think you want also to look for people who do come at it recognizing the entwinement of climate issues with other justice issues and the ways that these things fall differently, again, depending on where people are in the hierarchy, because those are often people who are proposing approaches or methods or even solutions that will also address other problems rather than making them worse.
Mm-hmm. There's another thing people might bump into, because it's so tiresome to say it again and again, but it's so true. We are so divided today politically. What we believe, how we perceive the world, we're divided over facts. We're divided over what a fact is. And I can imagine a little temerity on the part of the person who wants to reach out. If you reach out and talk about anything with even a little sting of politics, you're possibly moving into an area of confrontation. Is that an issue in any way with the people you talk to?
It can be. And I think I actually want to share something, if I may, a conversation that I had with my cousin, who's Jewish like me, about Palestine. He was saying that he had learned quite a bit about it, studied it, recognized that what's happening there now is unjust. But when he tried to talk to his peers about it, he would get kind of a stone wall and a kind of repetition of a refusal to listen. And I asked him, did you always think the way that you do now? And he said, no, you know, I learned about it, I studied about it, I talked to people, and I came to this new conclusion. And I said, what if you told the people that you're talking with, hey, I used to think what you thought, and here's what I looked at, heard from, here are the people that I listened to that made me change my mind to what I think now. And so I think that even when you're talking with someone who, I wouldn't say denies climate change, that's not that common, I think, anymore as a real position, mm-hmm. sometimes it's a political stance, but someone who says it's not a big deal, or someone who insists that they have no responsibility, or someone who, I don't know, thinks something else is more important, you can come still from this place of vulnerability that we talked about at the beginning of the show and say, here's why this is important to me. Here's why I'm choosing to give my time to it. And here's why I'm choosing to bring it up with you. Will that always work? No, I have seen it not work. I have felt it not work. But I have also seen and felt it work.
Hmm. Have you, and in fact, I'm cheating, I know the answer to this, but from the Nautilus article, you say that you haven't really had to deal with climate deniers coming up to you at all. No one coming up to you with an agenda or with an axe to grind. Has that been consistent over the 10 years you've been doing this?
It's very rare. Probably in a season, one or two people. I think that's because people who really don't think climate change is a real thing, they look at my little sign that says climate anxiety, they go, I don't have that, and they keep walking. Every so often, I do encounter someone who wants to pick a fight. And I have a pretty strong rule that I don't argue at the booth. Mm. So for example, somebody might come up and say, well, I'm not worried about climate change because that's not a real thing. And I would probably say, okay, well, what do you worry about? What are you worried about? Because another facet of the booth, and one that I built in from the very beginning, is that I was never going to turn anyone away for having an anxiety that I did not share. I did want to be a place where people could speak about whatever was troubling them. And I have listened to a lot of stories that they have their roots in the same thing that climate change has its roots in, which is exploitation, colonization, all the things that we know about that are hurting us to this day, but they're not necessarily overtly a climate issue. So sometimes if I say to someone, okay, well, what are you worried about if you're not worried about climate change? They will tell me a story. And that will give them an opportunity to not be alone with that story.
This is fascinating. We're going to take a quick break here and come back very quickly with Kate Shapiro. We're talking about her book, and it's all about the lessons that she has learned with a literal booth on climate anxiety. The book is called Lessons from the Climate Anxiety Counseling Booth, How to Live with Care and Purpose in an Endangered World. We're going to go a little more deeply into the chapters and verse of the book. There's a lot in there for all of us to learn from. As soon as we get to the other side of this break, we'll continue to take your calls and emails. Phone line is 866-798-TALK. That translates to 866-798-8255. We're also taking your emails. Your call at kalw.org. Rose Aguilar is out. I'm Angie Cuero sitting in. We'll be right back here on Your Call. Welcome back to Your Call. I'm Angie Cuero, and my guest has written a book all about climate anxiety and the advice that she has given out and the information and wisdom she has taken in as she set up her booth on the side of the sidewalk, Lessons from the Climate Anxiety Counseling Booth. Kate Shapira is on the line. And Kate, I want to ask you about, you paint such a realistic picture of American society, and you write that mainstream U.S. society's emphasis on sufficiency tells us we're supposed to be able to handle everything ourselves, that we don't need handouts, that, you know, it's the bootstrap thing. Americans got where they are today without help from anyone. I'm thinking of the work that you do at the booth and the conversations you have at the booth as they conflict with these cultural stories to blame ourselves and to blame each other. We talked a little bit about the anger, about the targeting of others when we're hurt or we're broke. And here it is, the dream house turns out to be in a flood zone and you're angry there. It's wonderful that you're making a dent. It's wonderful that you're giving people another way to look at it. But how resistant do you find some of these ideas? Because they're reinforced every day. You're on your own.
Again, it really depends. And also, and this is something that I know from being a teacher, you don't always see someone learn what they're learning with you at the moment that they're learning it. Mm-hmm. So, because people come to the booth and then they go away again, mostly, and then we don't see each other, I don't know how our conversations are landing with them the next time that they have to make a difficult decision at work, for example, about what they're going to support or speak up about. The next time that they have an opportunity to use some time of theirs to go down to the town hall and fight a fossil fuel project versus take a nap, which, hey, I hear you. I also like to take a nap. But it's entirely possible that something that didn't land when we were having our conversation does connect for them later on. It's also possible that the reverse happens, that we come to a place where they have something that they'd like to do to kind of ease the burden of this crisis on their community or on the world, and that they then lose speed after we talk to each other. I mostly don't get to see that. Mm-hmm. And so I think that kind of question of resistance to something that we've been taught we aren't supposed to do, to connect with others, to share with others, to trust others, sometimes I think probably that reasserts itself, that closed downness. And sometimes possibly because of the conversation that we've had, it opens up again later. I really don't know. And it's a flaw in the booth structure that it's just this brief encounter and then off we go.
Well, yeah, I guess that's a fair way to put it. But also, you can't be all things to all people the whole time. I mean, this is the corner that you've set aside for yourself, and it sounds like it's a very valuable and appreciated one. I also wonder, too, about some of the more unusual things that people come to you with. What are the rare or strange things that you hear?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. Let me think for a second. I actually did the booth yesterday at an indoor winter market, and I'm trying to think about what we discussed.
Okay.
I don't know if it's unusual, but I do, you know, it's hard actually, Angie, to think about what's unusual because, you know, what I mostly notice are the echoes, the repetitions, the things that are common among people. Mm-hmm. I would say it's unusual for someone to be in so much distress that it really is affecting their day-to-day life. I know that does happen with people, but I've really talked to very, very few people who are finding themselves impaired and going about their day because of this thing specifically. I would say it's unusual for people, it's very common for people to take a global lens in the sense that they recognize the scale of the problem. It's unusual for people to, on their own, make the connection between climate impacts and, say, war.
Mm.
Or genocide or occupation. Those are things that sometimes come up as we have the conversation. And I actually, now that I'm saying this, I remember a really powerful conversation that I had with someone about Palestine, talking about the ecological impact of all of the weaponry specifically, and of all of the destruction of infrastructure. That was somebody who came up to me, somebody probably, I want to say in their late 20s, early 30s, last season. And we talked for a long time about that. They were really feeling the weight of that. And we spent a lot of time together. I try to give more time if the person seems to be feeling something very heavily.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that there's that connection from X topic to global warming, to climate change, because in the last election, 37% of registered voters said that global warming is very important to their vote, just 37%, and that they want candidates who support action. Their other priorities were much higher, but it sounds as though one of the conversations that's worth having is the things that we posit as most important to us probably have an element of environment or global warming in it anyway.
1,000%. I'm really grateful to you for bringing that up. Another place that I see that happening a lot is housing.
Mm.
I spoke with Green Builder Media last summer. And when they were like, you know, oh, what's one thing that you can do for climate change in your community, or to, you know, to reduce the impact of climate change in your community? I said, rent control, rent stabilization, something that allows people to be able to afford to live where they live, that allows a community to accommodate people who have to move, something that prevents climate gentrification if it's a place where it seems safer to people who have money and the means to travel,
mm-hmm.
A place that keeps people, you know, a policy rather, that keeps people off the street, because if you're living outside, obviously you're going to get hit with extreme weather before anyone else. And those connections, right? So there's the connection of green housing and building more sustainably, building more energy efficient housing, using more sustainable materials, mining less, logging less, developing sustainably and using land sustainably. But there is also this very real question of housing justice and who gets to live inside.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I want to start looking at some of your chapters within the book. First title that intrigued me in chapter 2, you subtitled it From Fear and Hoarding to Planning and Welcome. Fear, I understand. Hoarding, where does that come in?
Well, let me ask you a question. Maybe this hasn't been part of your experience, but have you, when you have talked with people about climate change, have you ever heard in some of them an inclination that we might call like a prepper inclination? People who are like, well, I'm going to get a lot of bulk beans and
yes.
I'm going to build. Okay, thank you. I also have heard some of those people, including at the booth and elsewhere. And I want to kind of ask our listeners to think about that impulse in yourself, that impulse to stock up, hunker down, build a wall, right? Like, where's that coming from? What is it that's making you think that by interacting with other people less and sharing less, you will be more likely to survive?
Mm.
Like, be gentle with yourself about it. Don't assume you must be garbage for having had that impulse, but hold that impulse out and look at it. Where's that coming from? And I think also, and maybe even more importantly, where's it leading you?
Right. And there's an opening for activism there as well. And it almost seems like all things in the book, in one level or another, leads to activism, leads to becoming more aware, leads to looking outside yourself and outside your small window and seeing where everybody else is with this. And I can say true confessions. With my hoarding, I've made sure, literally, I have enough coffee for the entire neighborhood. I'm serious. If there's an earthquake, I know people are going to want coffee. So I have this massive stash of coffee. And it strikes me that it's that little bit of feeling like amongst all your prepping, you have something to share. There's a little chink in the wall there that you can build on.
Absolutely. I think in that chapter that you're talking about, I have a lot of conversations with people who are figuring out how to identify their community's abundance. What can they be generous with? What could they be generous with if they made a small shift or if they made contact with another person? That shift in thinking is, as you say, it's a tiny opening in that wall. What can I afford to give? And in a country where you can almost always tell yourself a story about scarcity and have that story be true, it is really powerful, I think, to be able to say, no, actually, I can be generous with this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You have a chapter on dealing with your company, your employer, your business that may have different priorities. That's not rare. It's often that you can espouse and live by your own wisdom and beliefs at home, but you have to go into a workplace that isn't taking things as urgently, that doesn't take it seriously at all, or that has an even higher master to answer to who likewise isn't doing the right thing for global warming. How do you deal with that?
There's a few different ways that people deal with that. I remember somebody coming and talking to me a couple of years ago about the hospital that she worked at, for example, and just the sheer volume of plastic waste that they generate there. And also, I think the concern about disaster of having electricity available right to the hospital itself. So she had sort of this mixed concern. One is, why does my job involve using so many petroleum products that are then wasted? And the other was, and what's going to happen to my patients if something goes really wrong? So we ended up talking about both of those things. And what I seem to remember that we discovered is that there was an organization working on reducing hospital waste that she could learn about. But that didn't necessarily guarantee that the particular hospital she worked at was going to go for it.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's also, and see, I wish I could talk to her again, because I now know that some hospitals have worked with unions and worked with the companies that run the hospitals themselves to set up solar generation, rooftop solar, for a hospital to make it more climate resilient.
Mm.
So sometimes there are levers and openings within the workplace itself, right? There's something that your employer wants for some other reason. You can work a reduction of climate impacts or a degree of climate preparedness or both into that. Sometimes it's going to turn out that your workplace is just not the place where you can do this work. It is not going to be the place that you fight for climate justice. It's going to be the place that pays your bills so that you can do other things on the weekend. And in that chapter, I talk a little bit, sorry to any employers who might be listening, about doing less at your job so that you can do more somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like a version of choosing your battles, choosing where to conserve your energy, choosing where to expend your energy. Within the workplace, there's bound to be a ceiling to what you can do. And part of it then is feeling out where the ceiling is and working within that limitation.
Exactly. And I think that there is maybe, certainly I think in kind of old school, quote unquote, big green, often white-led environmentalism, but also in U.S. culture broadly right now, there is a very either-or attitude toward trying to make change. That if something doesn't fix everything, then it's useless. It fixes nothing. It's worth exploring in the context of your workplace, in the context of your household, in the context of your community, in the context of your town or city government, whether that is really true.
Mm.
Whether there is something that isn't as good as what could be and really what should be, but that still reduces climate impacts, alleviates injustice, gives people more opportunities to recover from the strain they're under in order to build some power later, or just increases people's ability to take pleasure in the living world, that might be worth doing.
We have an email from someone. I'm really regretting that this person isn't here for a back and forth, because I'd love to hear them on the phone, but we can at least go to what they're asking here online. In 1966, in a brief stint as a file clerk with a fossil fuel company, I saw a whole file drawer of newspaper clippings about Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. They knew then about climate change, yet things are now a million times worse. I conclude with capitalism the way it is practiced, with the profit motive and no social responsibility. I'm glad I don't have children and think the world is doomed. I'm imagining that you have talked to people who are that, well, I guess settled in their mind. The evidence is in, the conclusion is made, the world is doomed.
Yeah, I've been that person too. And I think that maybe that is the first thing that I would say, is that it's possible to be that person, stop being that person, maybe be that person again for a little while. That is not, in fact, a fixed state. It's a state that it's possible to move in and out of. And I would also kind of add to that person, okay, well, if that's true, how do you want to live till then? You have some days that have been given to you. You don't know the length of them. Nobody does. But how do you want to be in the world? How do you want to live in the world? How could you care for the world while you're still in it and it's still part of you?
This has been so valuable. I really appreciate all your time on this, Katie. I appreciate the book, and I hope people pick it up and take it a really good look there. Thank you.
Thank you. It's really been a great pleasure to talk with you, and I wish everyone luck.
Kate Shapiro teaches nonfiction writing with a focus on narrative, diverse formal strategies, and environmental and ecological storytelling. She's the author of Time to Be Something Other Than Human, 6 collections of poetry, and we've been discussing her latest book, Lessons from the Climate Anxiety Counseling Booth, How to Live with Care and Purpose in an Endangered World. You can listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast. Visit yourcallradio.org. You can find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. Email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Deep thanks to Maliha Razazan for producing today's show, and to Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Angie Cuero, sitting in for Rose today. It's Your Call.